Chapter 21. Ivanogarov was bringing up the main body of the army of the Emir. The cavalry and infantry now under him had formed part of the column which had taken Omsk. Agarov, not having been able to reduce the high town, in which, it must be remembered, the governor and garrison had sought refuge, had decided to pass on, not wishing to delay operations which ought to lead to the conquest of eastern Siberia. He therefore left a garrison in Omsk, and, reinforcing himself en route with the conquerors of Kolyvan, joined Feofor's army. Ivanogarov's soldiers halted at the outposts of the camp. They received no orders to bivouac. Their chief's plan, doubtless, was not to halt there, but to press on and reach Tomsk in the shortest possible time, it being an important town, naturally intended to become the center of future operations. Besides his soldiers, Agarov was bringing a convoy of Russian and Siberian prisoners, captured either at Omsk or Kolyvan. These unhappy creatures were not led to the enclosure already too crowded, but were forced to remain at the outposts without shelter, almost without nourishment. What fate was Feofor Khan reserving for these unfortunates? Would he imprison them in Tomsk, or would some bloody execution, familiar to the Tartar chiefs, remove them when they were found too inconvenient? This was the secret of the capricious Emir. This army had not come from Omsk and Kolyvan without bringing in its train the usual crowd of beggars, freebooters, peddlers, and gypsies, which compose the rear guard of an army on the march. All these people lived on the country traversed, and left little of anything behind them. There was, therefore, a necessity for pushing forward, if only to secure provisions for the troops. The whole region between Ichim and Teyobi, now completely devastated, no longer offered any resources. The Tartars left a desert behind them. Conspicuous among the gypsies who had hastened from the western provinces was the Tsigan troop, which had accompanied Michael Strogoff as far as Perm. Sanger was there. This fierce spy, the tool of Ivanogarov, had not deserted her master. Agarov had traveled rapidly to Ichim, whilst Sanger and her band had proceeded to Omsk by the southern part of the province. It may be easily understood how useful this woman was to Agarov. With her gypsy band she could penetrate anywhere. Ivanogarov was kept acquainted with all that was going on in the very heart of the invaded provinces. There were 100 eyes, 100 ears, open in his service. Besides, he paid liberally for this espionage, from which he derived so much advantage. Once Sanger, being implicated in a very serious affair, had been saved by the Russian officer. She never forgot what she owed him, and had devoted herself to his service body and soul. When Ivanogarov entered on the path of treason, he saw at once how he might turn this woman to account. Whatever order he might give her, Sanger would execute it. An inexplicable instinct, more powerful still than that of gratitude, had urged her to make herself the slave of the traitor to whom he had been attached since the very beginning of his exile in Siberia. Confident and accomplice, Sanger, without country, without family, had been delighted to put her vagabond life to the service of the invaders thrown by Agarov on Siberia. To the wonderful cunning natural to her race she added a wild energy, which knew neither forgiveness nor pity. She was a savage worthy to share the wigwam of an Apache, or the hut of an Andaman. Since her arrival at Omsk, whereas he had rejoined him with her Tsigans, Sanger had not again left Agarov. The circumstance that Michael and Marfa Strogoff had met was known to her. She knew and shared Agarov's fears concerning the journey of a courier of the Tsar. Having Marfa Strogoff in her power, she would have been the woman to torture her with all the refinement of a redskin in order to wrest her secret from her. But the hour had not yet come in which Agarov wished the old Siberian to speak. Sanger had to wait, and she waited, without losing sight of her whom she was watching, observing her slightest gestures, her slightest words, endeavoring to catch the word on escaping from her lips, but as yet all was baffled by Marfa's taciturnity. At the first flourish of the trumpets, several officers of high rank, followed by a brilliant escort of Uzbek horsemen, moved to the front of the camp to receive Ivanogorov. Arrived in his presence, they paid him the greatest respect, and invited him to accompany them to Feofor Khan's tent. Imperturbable as usual, Ogorov replied coldly to the deference paid to him. He was plainly dressed, but, from a sort of impudent bravado, he still wore the uniform of a Russian officer. As he was about to enter the camp, Sanger, passing among the officers, approached and remained motionless before him. "Nothing?" asked Ogorov. "Nothing. Have patience. Is the time approaching when you will force the old woman to speak?" "It is approaching, Sanger." "When will the old woman speak?" "When we reach Tomsk. And we shall be there in 3 days." A strange gleam shot from Sanger's great black eyes, and she retired with a calm step. Ogorov pressed his spurs into his horse's flanks, and, followed by his staff of Tartar officers, rode towards the Emir's tent. Feofor Khan was expecting his lieutenant. The council, composed of the bearer of the royal seal, the Khaja, and some high officers, had taken their places in the tent. Ivanogorov dismounted and entered. Feofor Khan was a man of 40, tall, rather pale, of a fierce countenance, and evil eyes. A curly black beard flowed over his chest. With his war costume, coat of mail of gold and silver, crossbelt and scabbard glistening with precious stones, boots with golden spurs, helmet ornamented with an aigrette of brilliant diamonds, Feofor presented an aspect rather strange than imposing for a Tartar Sardanapalus, an undisputed sovereign, who directs at his pleasure the life and fortune of his subjects. When Ivanogorov appeared, the great dignitaries remained seated on their gold-embroidered cushions. But Feofor rose from a rich divan which occupied the back part of the tent, the ground being hidden under the thick velvet pile of a Bukharian carpet. The Emir approached Ogorov and gave him a kiss, the meaning of which he could not mistake. This kiss made the lieutenant chief of the council, and placed him temporarily above the Khaja. Then Feofor spoke. "Have no need to question you," said he. "Speak, Ivan. You will find your ears very ready to listen to you." "Taxer," answered Ogorov, "this is what I have to make known to you." He spoke in the Tartar language, giving to his phrases the emphatic turn which distinguishes the languages of the Orientals. "Axer, this is not the time for unnecessary words. What I have done at the head of your troops, you know. The lines of the Ichim and the Irtych are now in our power, and the Turkoman horsemen can bathe their horses in the now Tartar waters. The Kyrgyz hordes rose at the voice of Feofor Khan. You can now push your troops towards the east, and where the sun rises, or towards the west, where he sets." "And if I march with the sun?" asked the Emir, without his countenance betraying any of his thoughts. "To march with the sun," answered Ogorov, "is to throw yourself towards Europe. It is to conquer rapidly the Siberian provinces of Tobolsk as far as the Ural Mountains. And if I go to meet this luminary of the heavens? It is to subdue to the Tartar dominion, with Irkutsk, the richest countries of Central Asia." "But the armies of the Sultan of St. Petersburg?" said Feofor Khan, designating the Emperor of Russia by this strange title. "You have nothing to fear from them," replied Ivanogorov. "The invasion has been sudden, and before the Russian army can succor them, Irkutsk or Tobolsk will have fallen into your power. The Tsar's troops have been overwhelmed at Kolyvan, as they will be everywhere where yours meet them." "And what advice does your devotion to the Tartar cause suggest?" asked the Emir, after a few moments' silence. "My advice," answered Ivanogorov quickly, "is to march to meet the sun. It is to give the grass of the eastern steppes to the Turkoman horses to consume. It is to take Irkutsk, the capital of the eastern provinces, and with it a hostage, the possession of whom is worth a whole country. In the place of the Tsar, the Grand Duke his brother must fall into your hands." This was the great result aimed at by Ivanogorov. to listen to him, one would have taken him for one of the cruel descendants of Stephen Razin, the celebrated pirate who ravaged southern Russia in the 18th century. To seize the Grand Duke, murder him pitilessly, would fully satisfy his hatred. Besides, with the capture of Irkutsk, all eastern Siberia would pass to the Tartars. "It shall be thus, Ivan," replied Feofor. "What are your orders, Taxer?" "Today our headquarters shall be removed to Tomsk." Agarov bowed, and, followed by the Auschbegwit, he retired to execute the Emir's orders. As he was about to mount his horse, to return to the outposts, a tumult broke out at some distance, in the part of the camp reserved for the prisoners. Shouts were heard, and two or three shots fired. Perhaps it was an attempt at revolt or escape, which must be summarily suppressed. Ivan Agarov and the Auschbegui walked forward, and almost immediately two men, whom the soldiers had not been able to keep back, appeared before them. The Auschbegui, without more information, made a sign which was an order for death, and the heads of the two prisoners would have rolled on the ground, had not Agarov uttered a few words which arrested the sword already raised aloft. The Russian had perceived that these prisoners were strangers, and he ordered them to be brought to him. They were Harry Blount and Alcide Jolivet. On Agarov's arrival in the camp, they had demanded to be conducted to his presence. The soldiers had refused. In consequence, a struggle, an attempt at flight, shots fired which happily missed the two correspondents, but their execution would not have been long delayed if it had not been for the intervention of the Emir's lieutenant. The latter observed the prisoners for some moments, they being absolutely unknown to him. They had been present at that scene in the post house at Itchum, in which Michael Strogoff had been struck by Agarov. But the brutal traveler had paid no attention to the persons then collected in the common room. Blount and Jolivet, on the contrary, recognized him at once, and the latter said in a low voice, "Hello. It seems that Colonel Agarov and the rude personage of Itchum are one." Then he added in his companion's ear, "Explain our affair, Blount. You will do me a service. This Russian colonel in the midst of a Tartar camp disgusts me, and although, thanks to him, my head is still on my shoulders, my eyes would exhibit my feelings were I to attempt to look him in the face." So saying, Alcide Jolivet assumed a look of complete and haughty indifference. Whether or not Ivan Agarov perceived that the prisoner's attitude was insulting towards him, he did not let it appear. "Who are you, gentlemen?" he asked in Russian, in a cold tone, but free from its usual rudeness. "Two correspondents of English and French newspapers," replied Blount laconically. "You have, doubtless, papers which will establish your identity? Here are letters which accredit us in Russia, from the English and French Chancellor's office." Ivan Agarov took the letters which Blount held out, and read them attentively. "Who ask," said he, "authorization to follow our military operations in Siberia?" "We ask to be free, that is all," answered the English correspondent dryly. "You are so, gentlemen," answered Agarov. "I am curious to read your articles in the Daily Telegraph." "Sir," replied Blount, with the most imperturbable coolness, "it is sixpence a number, including postage." And thereupon he returned to his companion, who appeared to approve completely of his replies. Ivan Agarov, without frowning, mounted his horse, and going to the head of his escort, soon disappeared in a cloud of dust. "Well, Jolivet, what do you think of Colonel Ivan Agarov, General-in-Chief of the Tartar troops?" asked Blount. "I think, my dear friend," replied Alcide, smiling, "that the Auschbegui made a very graceful gesture when he gave the order for our heads to be cut off." Whatever was the motive which led Agarov to act thus in regard to the two correspondents, they were free, and could rove at their pleasure over the scene of war. Their intention was not to leave it. The sort of antipathy which formerly they had entertained for each other had given place to a sincere friendship. Circumstances having brought them together, they no longer thought of separating. The petty questions of rivalry were forever extinguished. Terry Blount could never forget what he owed his companion, who, on the other hand, never tried to remind him of it. This friendship too assisted the reporting operations, and was thus to the advantage of their readers. And now, asked Blount, what shall we do with our liberty? Take advantage of it, of course, replied Alcide, and go quietly to Tomsk, to see what is going on there. Until the time very near, I hope when we may rejoin some Russian regiment? As you say, my dear Blount, it won't do to Tartarize ourselves too much. The best side is that of the most civilized army, and it is evident that the people of Central Asia will have everything to lose, and absolutely nothing to gain from this invasion, while the Russians will soon repulse them. It is only a matter of time. The arrival of Ivan Ogarev, which had given Jolovin and Blount their liberty, was to Michael Strogoff, on the contrary, a serious danger. Should chance bring the Tsar's courier into Ogarev's presence, the latter could not fail to recognize in him the traveler whom he had so brutally treated at the Ichim post house, and although Michael had not replied to the insult as he would have done under any other circumstances, attention would be drawn to him, and at once the accomplishment of his plans would be rendered more difficult. This was the unpleasant side of the business. A favorable result of his arrival, however, was the order which was given to raise the camp that very day, and remove the headquarters to Tomsk. This was the accomplishment of Michael's most fervent desire. His intention, as has been said, was to reach Tomsk concealed amongst the other prisoners. That is to say, without any risk of falling into the hands of the scouts who swarmed about the approaches to this important town. However, in consequence of the arrival of Ivan Ogarev, he questioned whether it would not be better to give up his first plan and attempt to escape during the journey. Michael would, no doubt, have kept to the latter plan had he not learnt that Feofor Khan and Ogarev had already set out for the town with some thousands of horsemen. We'll wait then, said he to himself, at least, unless some exceptional opportunity for escape occurs. The adverse chances are numerous on this side of Tomsk, while beyond I shall in a few hours have passed the most advanced Tartar posts to the east. Still 3 days of patience, and may God aid me. It was indeed a journey of 3 days which the prisoners, under the guard of a numerous detachment of Tartars, were to make across the steppe. 150 versts lay between the camp and the town, an easy march for the Emir's soldiers, who wanted for nothing but a wretched journey for these people, enfeebled by privations. More than one corpse would show the road they had traversed. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, on the 12th of August, under a hot sun and cloudless sky, that the Topchai Bashi gave the order to start. Alcide and Blount, having bought horses, had already taken the road to Tomsk, where events were to reunite the principal personages of this story. Amongst the prisoners brought by Ivan Ogarev to the Tartar camp was an old woman, whose taciturnity seemed to keep her apart from all those who shared her fate. Not a murmur issued from her lips. She was like a statue of grief. This woman was more strictly guarded than anyone else, and, without her appearing to notice, was constantly watched by the Tsigan Sangar. Notwithstanding her age, she was compelled to follow the convoy of prisoners on foot, without any alleviation of her suffering. However, a kind providence had placed near her a courageous, kind-hearted being to comfort and assist her. Amongst her companions in misfortune, a young girl, remarkable for beauty and taciturnity, seemed to have given herself the task of watching over her. No words had been exchanged between the two captives, but the girl was always at the old woman's side when help was useful. At first, the mute assistance of the stranger was accepted with some mistrust. Gradually, however, the young girl's clear glance, her reserve, and the mysterious sympathy which draws together those who are in misfortune, thawed Marfa Strogoff's coldness. Nadia, for it was she, was thus able, without knowing it, to render to the mother those attentions which she had herself received from the son. Her instinctive kindness had doubly inspired her. and devoting herself to her service, Nadia secured to her youth and beauty the protection afforded by the age of the old prisoner. On the crowd of unhappy people, embittered by sufferings, the silent pair, one seeming to be the grandmother, the other the granddaughter, imposed a sort of respect. After being carried off by the Tartar scouts on the Irtych, Nadia had been taken to Omsk. Kept prisoner in the town, she shared the fate of all those captured by Ivan Ogarov, and consequently that of Marfa Strogoff. If Nadia had been less energetic, she would have succumbed to this double blow. The interruption to her journey, the death of Michael, made her both desperate and excited. Divided, perhaps forever, from her father, after so many happy efforts had brought her near him, and, to crown her grief, separated from the intrepid companion whom God seemed to have placed in her way to lead her. The image of Michael Strogoff, struck before her eyes with a lance, and disappearing beneath the waters of the Irtych, never left her thoughts. Could such a man have died thus? For whom was God reserving his miracles, if this good man, whom a noble object was urging onwards, had been allowed to perish so miserably? Then anger would prevail over grief. The scene of the affront so strangely borne by her companion at the Ichim relay returned to her memory. Her blood boiled at the recollection. Who will avenge him who can no longer avenge himself? She said. And in her heart, she cried, may it be I. If before his death Michael had confided his secret to her, woman, aye girl though she was, she might have been able to carry to a successful conclusion the interrupted task of that brother whom God had so soon taken from her. Absorbed in these thoughts, it can be understood how Nadia could remain insensible to the miseries even of her captivity. Thus chance had united her to Marfa Strogoff without her having the least suspicion of who she was. How could she imagine that this old woman, a prisoner like herself, was the mother of him, whom she only knew as the merchant Nicholas Korpanov? And on the other hand, how could Marfa guess that a bond of gratitude connected this young stranger with her son? The thing that first struck Nadia in Marfa Strogoff was the similarity in the way in which each bore her hard fate. This stoicism of the old woman under the daily hardships, this contempt of bodily suffering, could only be caused by a moral grief equal to her own. So Nadia thought, and she was not mistaken. It was an instinctive sympathy for that part of her misery which Marfa did not show which first drew Nadia towards her. This way of bearing her sorrow went to the proud heart of the young girl. She did not offer her services, she gave them. Marfa had neither to refuse nor accept them. In the difficult parts of the journey, the girl was there to support her. When the provisions were given out, the old woman would not have moved, but Nadia shared her small portion with her, and thus this painful journey was performed. Thanks to her companion, Marfa was able to follow the soldiers who guarded the prisoners without being fastened to a saddle bow, as were many other unfortunate wretches, and thus dragged along this road of sorrow. May God reward you, my daughter, for what you have done for my old age, said Marfa Strogoff once, and for some time these were the only words exchanged between the two unfortunate beings. During these few days, which to them appeared like centuries, it would seem that the old woman and the girl would have been led to speak of their situation. But Marfa Strogoff, from a caution which may be easily understood, never spoke about herself except with the greatest brevity. She never made the smallest allusion to her son, nor to the unfortunate meeting. Nadia also, if not completely silent, spoke little. However, one day her heart overflowed, and she told all the events which had occurred from her departure from Vladimir to the death of Nicholas Korpanov. All that her young companion told intensely interested the old Siberian. Icholas Korpanov, said she. Tell me again about this Nicholas. I know only one man, one alone, in whom such conduct would not have astonished me. Nicholas Korpanov. Was that really his name? Are you sure of it, my daughter? Why should he have deceived me in this, replied Nadia, when he deceived me in no other way? Moved, however, by a kind of presentiment, Marfa Strogoff put questions upon questions to Nadia. You told me he was fearless, my daughter. You have proved that he has been so? Asked she. Yes, fearless indeed, replied Nadia. It was just what my son would have done, said Marfa to herself. Then she resumed, did you not say that nothing stopped him, nor astonished him, that he was so gentle in his strength, that you had a sister as well as a brother in him, and he watched over you like a mother? Yes, yes, said Nadia. Brother, sister, mother, he has been all to me. And defended you like a lion? A lion indeed, replied Nadia. Lion, a hero. My son, thought the old Siberian. Adieu said, however, that he bore a terrible insult at that post house in Itchum. He did bear it, answered Nadia, looking down. He bore it, murmured Marfa, shuddering. Mother, mother, cried Nadia, do not blame him. He had a secret of which God alone is as yet the judge. And, said Marfa, raising her head and looking at Nadia, as though. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.